Welcome to Extroverted Developer, a new podcast about computer programming and technology in New York City. I'm Jim Wallace.
And I'm Ben Gunderson.
All right, today we're going to talk about some more current event-y type stuff. Right. First, let's announce our Facebook page. We created a Facebook page. Like us on Facebook. If you go to extrovertedeveloper.com, on the right-hand side, there's a little like button there. You can click that, and then you'll get our updates on Facebook, where we post stories that we don't do on the show necessarily for comment and,
right.
and user interface.
When people hang out with other developers and, you know, be all
extroverted. I feel like the comment system on Squarespace, which is hosting our podcast, is a little cumbersome because their CAPTCHA is, like, too good.
Right.
It's hard to read. Yeah. Like, it's hard for humans
to
read.
They just reCAPTCHA.
Something like that. And as a result, I've had trouble writing comments on our blog. And so Facebook seems like a much better system for that.
I bought tickets from Ticketmaster recently and had to fight their CAPTCHA system. And they use reCAPTCHA. It's awful.
That's funny.
It's impossible to read the black and white version of it. They have like a black and white next to a photo. And it's just a huge pain. Everything about Ticketmaster is a huge pain. So
I know some artist, Louis C.K., has said that he's not going to do Ticketmaster anymore. He actually has his own ticketing company.
I'm hoping to go to that show in October.
Are you?
Yeah.
Oh, rock on. All right, so let's start off talking about device-independent pixels and REM in the webland. You know a bit more about this than I do. I am not...
I actually was reading a pretty fascinating article recently about... apparently in CSS3 there's a new... measurement for type, which is the REM unit. And most people are familiar with the pixel unit, obviously, and also the M unit. And M is just like in typography, it is relative to the size of size of the M, and it's also relative to its parent element. And so, if you put like star 0.9, the deeper you were in the DOM, the smaller the type would be. And this presents some interesting issues because you never. Your markup could actually kind of affect the relative size of of the fonts around it. So REM is root M, which means it's relative to the root.
Always, no matter where you are in the DOM.
Right, exactly. So you could just set your size. I'm actually surprised they didn't do this kind of in the first place because it actually.
I'm a little surprised too because this is definitely available in many other systems that have to worry about device. And this is becoming important because of Retina displays and things like that are coming from Apple, really pushing. The bounds of that phone.
It makes scaling really easy. You can just, 1.2.
Right. So the idea is that no matter what your pixel density is on the screen, whatever you specify will be the size on whatever screen. So it abstracts away pixel density from you.
Right.
So that when you specify that this is 20 wide and you see that on a 96 dots per inch monitor and you see it on a 200 dots per inch, like an iPad 3, it will actually be the exact same size on the two, or in theory.
And they were mentioning some interesting side effects, which I wasn't previously aware of. That it's actually best to use REM with integer values and not use
floating points.
Yeah, and because different browsers round differently when. IE6, for example, will actually round up, which is why in some cases when you have like if you have a 50 pixel wide thing and you divide it into three equal parts, it'll actually round up and if you float them all together, the last one will get dropped off because it's one pixel too wide for its container. now that makes a lot of sense why there was so much
disparity in the
I6, there were some interesting test cases they showed off where WebKit versus Mozilla would actually, in some cases, would just chop off an extra pixel, and things like that. So, looking forward to anti-aliasing or whatever the right solution for that is someday.
Well, I think you said in the last podcast that anti-aliasing won't be the solution. We'll just have super high density displays, and we won't need to anti-alias because our eyes won't be able to see jaggies,
and you won't really have 1 pixel wide lines anymore.
Right. Mm-hmm. And this device independent pixel has been implemented in several places. I first encountered it in WPF, Windows Presentation Foundation, but really Avalon. Come on, naming. Microsoft is terrible at naming. Did you see recently that they Slate? It's not just the Slate or the Surface. They can't just call it Surface. It's like Surface Windows something.
Windows Live Surface.
Windows Live Surface.net.
RT Ultimate Pack 3.5.
Microsoft. Anyway, but Avalon was a really great technology, and they used device-independent pixels in anticipation of higher resolution displays or higher pixel density displays, even though there really aren't higher pixel density displays for the PC market, except in the really high end.
Right.
Like the graphics PCs. Design.
And I'm really hoping Apple pushes PC manufacturers and other tablet manufacturers.
I think they already have. I mean, they did with the iPhone. They came out with the Retina display on the iPhone, and then suddenly all of the Android devices had high-density screens, right?
Exactly.
Because once somebody makes it, then the other Chinese people or the other Chinese factories have access to the same technology. They're all made on the same.
Right, and I think we'll see Dell and Acer release laptops that are slimline laptops with, like, 2,500.
Interestingly, in iOS development, you don't really specify pixel widths and heights and things like that. Like, you don't... You're always working in device-independent pixels.
Oh,
you don't have a choice. Yeah. They make a lot of really good default choices.
Well, they only have two ratios. They have 1x and 2x.
Right, and then 2x. And they've done that to make it easier for developers and people to not care about.
Definitely succeeded.
When you have control over the hardware involved, you can make many more assumptions than you could in, say, Droid development.
Yeah, that's a great point. But Android does have device-independent DPs, right?
They do. Yeah, I ran into that actually recently. I was doing the mobile application for my company, and until I realized that such a thing existed, the DIPs, I just could not get the things to work on all of them properly across the different phone platforms.
Yeah.
There's that much variation from even individual phones within the same manufacturer line.
You still running an Evo?
I still have an Evo, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, Android, especially this is especially important for tablets. Android will try to scale up the application, right? Just by default,
it will. It's not. I mean, it does a decent job for large block items, but when you're looking for pixel perfect alignment,
right?
It doesn't work.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm excited about that. In combination with reactive technologies, reactive websites, this is a good, where I think we're headed in the right direction. Like, finally, pixel density, that's what I've always wanted.
Absolutely, yeah. I think I might have mentioned this last week, but I think the reason people get eye strain from computers is not the backlit screens. I think it's just I think that everything is slightly blurry.
I think so too. And you can really see that. So I went ahead and bought the MacBook Pro with Retina display.
Right, yes.
And so my justification is, like, I'm a computer programmer and I stare at this thing all the time and I need my eyes to be as good as possible. And I stick with that, actually. Yeah. I think a perfectly fine justification. Yeah. Oh, also, before everybody gets mad at me and thinking I'm unemployed and buying these expensive things, no, I have another job. I'm going to start on Thursday.
Now, actually, I haven't really read up on the Retina display. I'm more on the PC side of the wall. What is it?
It's just a high-density pixels per inch. So, like, you see it here. We're recording the podcast on my new 15-inch MacBook Pro. And what you can see is that I've got lots of space and the text is really sharp as well. The screen resolution is like 20-something. I don't want
to
say
it. It's interesting to me, though, that Apple's definition of Retina display, the DPI, is actually decreasing with each, each next product.
Because yes.
The dust per inch of the iPhone 4 is what? It's 260. It's really high. And then
iPhone is the highest,
little less.
And then the iPad, little
less. And I think they're down to like 140 or something for.
Really, I thought it was still 230. But anyway, these things are easily looked up online.
But still, it's like 90 for any other screen, right? I mean,
yeah, it's 96 or 72 was before
72,
that.
And I think there it's like your average screen is now like 96, 100.
Right, they're all like 1080p.
They're still pushing it way beyond what everyone else is doing.
You know, it occurs to me, especially with like all the recent changes and advances in LCD technology, that we're going to come to a point real soon where we can, for lack of a better phrase, overlap individual LCD pixels to get almost pseudo subpixel accuracy.
You're saying have two planes of pixels on the dot.
Effectively, but your eye won't be able to
right, because they'll be next to each other within
small of a distance.
Micrometers of each other.
Right. But you could probably give the appearance of, say, a subpixel line.
They had to sort of do that.
A little bit.
In the iPad, they had to sort of do that. They had to lift the pixels up off of the control surface because of the cross chatter that was happening in the
wires.
Yeah,
they're all capacitive.
Right, they're all capacitive, and so like when they're when they're close together, the signals cross.
A whole bunch of capacitors right under the control surface.
Exactly. Yeah. But that's all I had to say about that. I'm happy that device-independent pixels are going. Those of you out there in web development, you should look into REM. They recommend the order is different, right? You say your pixels first and followed by a REM statement. So you do one right after the other when you're specifying a size.
Well, and subsequent calls to the for size, you always specify REM instead of M.
Right.
And, you know, in your root element, you just specify pixels or whatever it is you want to. Or
oh, that's perfect. Default. Okay. So, yeah, we should start looking at that. When I'm working on Open Price Map, I'll definitely take a look at REM in my CSS. And, yay.
Just as, like, a trailing comment, what kind of support are they looking at across browsers?
That's a good question.
Every browser would have to implement it themselves.
Yeah, it's CSS 3 spec, but, you know.
Interestingly, Safari is the only browser on OS X that supports the Retina display on the OS, and so all of your text looks super sharp in Safari, and it's a little messed up in Chrome, and so I'm using Safari.
Speaking of Safari and Chrome, did you download the Chrome browser for iOS?
No,
they released Chrome for iOS.
Oh, rock on!
Instantly went to the top of the App Store too. Just that day.
Did you hear that they kind of? And this is rumor at this point, but they kind of crippled the V8 engine, the JavaScript engine. So, it's not
Chrome,
nearly as nice.
Wait, Google did?
No. Something... I'm going completely from hearsay, but the engine is...
I think... I'm not sure they're even allowed to use V8, because Apple really limits what you can do with browsers on OS. You actually have to use the UI WebKit view.
Well, it was pretty obvious Google had the app... Like that linked to all their other apps. It was like the one Google app.
Yeah, the Google search app.
The search app, right? And it was pretty obvious that they were not running Safari in that app, right?
But you could only have one tab open at a time, and it was kind of a pain. But Chrome for iOS is pretty nice.
Oh, rock on. Yeah. I'll go grab that. Nice. Yeah. This moves on to our next topic. No segue. That's how I roll. this probably happened a couple of weeks ago, but we did the Santos interview last week. So let's talk about PadMapper and Craigslist.
Oh, right. Yeah.
I'm not going to lie. I think it's crazy that people are still trying to build on top of the Craigslist platform. This is probably like the 10th time I've seen an apartment mapping service get taken down by Craigslist. It's like no one's learning from history.
Right. These guys were making a living on PadMapper too, right? I mean, this was...
Yeah, they're trying to make a company out of it.
Right, so, I mean, they're just out of a job now because Craigslist... I mean...
I don't think so. They've got other data sources.
But...
Well, that, I think, is the key, right? The big hype on the internet is... I've heard several arguments, which is like, it's not Craigslist data, it's your data. False. You put it into Craigslist.
Yeah.
Sorry. That's like how it works.
Right.
And then the other one is that Craigslist has a monopoly on this data. And no, they don't. You can create your own competing Craigslist thing. What they have is network effects, right?
Right.
People go there, like buyers go there because sellers are there, and sellers go there because buyers are there, right? And I've heard lots of arguments like, oh, but Craigslist sucks, and like it's all because their UX is terrible and all that stuff. But you actually
love their UX. Yeah, it's extremely simple, and it's completely intentional. The site is...
It works just like the classifieds did, only slightly better because it's links.
Right.
Right? And that's a good metaphor. It seems to work well. And if you think that the reason... like your thing is better than Craigslist is because of UX, go ahead and create your better UX version of Craigslist and then watch it fail in the marketplace. It turns out that people don't care about that. They care about buyers being there and sellers being there and not so much
Craigslist,
the technology.
The UX of Craigslist really reminds people of the newspaper. It's really, it's really non-scary. It's very easy to get into. And it just feels kind of comforting in its simplicity.
And its simplicity to scrape, apparently.
It's very easy to scrape, too, which I think, I mean, it's very well organized and, you know,
not to divert the topic, but there's kind of an interesting parallel between this new wave of startups that are built upon the foundation of a mashup concept, where all of your functionality effectively is being outsourced or is linked directly to an external company, because you're completely at the whim of that company as it rises and falls.
Right.
And the parallels I see, you know, since I'm recently from finance, is the way that all of the different bonds and foreign exchange markets are kind of intrinsically linked. Like when your business through five different chains is connected to the Greece bond market, when Greece falls, you get screwed.
Yeah, this is especially the case because so many of these APIs are effectively kind of, they're not really SLAs or anything like that, but you still have kind of, you kind of have a right to that data, right? You signed up, you got the key, you're within your API limitations. If they cut you off, you can at least kind of legitimately bitch if Facebook or
as long as you're following all the terms of service. But at the end of the day,
if they want to cut you off,
it's their data. They can cut you off and do whatever they want to. And so I'm surprised. Like, it's kind of a milestone. You know that you've made it when other people's livelihoods are dependent on your company.
Right.
That is like a sign of success.
That's a platform, right? If you want to be a platform, you have to. You don't want the chilling effects of cutting people off. Craigslist clearly does not want to be a platform, and they've shown that over and over again.
I did think it was funny that many Twitter clients were more profitable than Twitter.
Right. Yeah. And then Twitter bought some.
And I say this is the same thing, right? People are writing Twitter clients, and that's their livelihood, and they're dependent on this Twitter platform, just like other people are doing these apps on Craigslist.
I think this is why a lot of companies are now hesitant to build on Twitter as a platform, though.
Yeah.
Because Twitter has this history.
Yeah, I agree.
People off, right? So even things like login with Twitter hasn't gotten nearly the adoption it might have. So
it does seem like login with Facebook is much more popular.
Yeah. Well, the data you get is better, but still.
At least with the little games that you see on the sides.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of companies that use that as their only registration system. Turntable. You can't sign up for Turntable without Facebook. You can't sign up for Spotify without
Facebook. I am actually pro this.
Yeah.
I am pro somebody who really knows security and authentication, implementing it correctly, and then passing me a token saying that, yes, this person is authenticated.
Right.
Right.
That's the whole reason OAuth exists, right?
Right, that's what OAuth is.
Yeah. And I'm, okay, I don't want to write an authentication system. Are you kidding? I've got security training. Like, Microsoft makes you take mandatory annual security training ever since MBlaster, right? And so I actually have security training, and many developers I know don't. Yeah. And even I can't write an error-free authentication system, like, heaven forbid, right? I would not want to touch that problem.
And it's not just developers. I mean, we're hiring security specific people now. So I've been interviewing like director of security type people who don't actually know the difference between, say, cryptographic hashes and password level hashes. I mean, it's just something that's kind of innate to the craft, and they just have no concept.
Do you think it's important that they actually know how it works or that they know how to use that to secure a system?
I think it's more important the usage of it. The implementation details, it's kind of like, yes, I know my toilet works. I don't necessarily need to know how it works, right?
And you know how to use it.
I do know how to use the toilet.
Right.
Excellent.
And so much of security is that domain knowledge. It's not just being a good programmer.
Right. But that thing about people making their livelihood, that sort of transitions us nice into our next topic, which is about profitability per company. So when this story about PadMapper came out, you took a look, or this reminded you of an article that had come
out. Right, I had seen this article a couple of years ago. I think it's from early 2011, where they graphed out profitability of several different companies per employee. So this isn't the greatest way to determine, you know.
Right. It wasn't profitability. It was revenue per employee.
It was profit per employee.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, it was profit per employee. Now, you know, if you wanted to make this a little better, you'd take, you know, average salary and things like that into account, which they didn't. But those numbers are harder to get for
private. Yeah.
Right. But, apparently, Craigslist, surprisingly enough, is the most profitable company in the U.S. per employee. They have like 30 employees working for them and make, you know, I don't know what they're at.
10 million or something?
It's like, it's in the hundreds of millions of dollars.
Oh, okay.
Per year.
I could click on those.
It's just the very small number of people they need to do that. I'm actually interested to see where
100 million
Pinterest stands in this as well, because I believe Pinterest is still in less than 24 employees now. So
I know that you think that Craigslist is this great thing.
You know, I don't actually even use Craigslist all that often, but I do have a lot of respect for them, and I really like Craig Newmark. So
I'm going to have to sort of go ahead and disagree with you a little bit.
All right. It's fun when we disagree.
Yeah. The reason is because Craigslist came in and is a disruptive change for the newspapers, right?
Right.
And that's fine. Like, we need disruptive technologies to come in and do that. But when Craigslist killed the newspapers, so newspapers used to use classified ad funding to fund.
That was one of their biggest revenue sources.
It was their primary revenue
source. Cut their legs off.
Right. It cut their legs off, and what they were doing with that money, I mean, I'm sure they were getting rich and stuff too, but they were funding investigative journalism, right? Like, they were going into corrupt systems and, like, embedding reporters and doing these things. And
that's the end justifies the means. So that's not a good argument for newspapers. I mean, it's a good argument that means we need better. You're saying we need better journalism. I don't think anyone disagrees with that.
Mm-hmm.
But saying that Craigslist doing a better classifieds is a bad thing because now newspapers can't hire good journalists.
They can't embed reporters anymore, and we can't get the news anymore because of it. So the problem isn't that Craigslist
bad journalism today's poor journalistic practices or on the feet of Craigslist though. You can't.
No, I think I can. Absolutely. Like, that money dried up. They had no other revenue. And then the thing is that Craig Newmark didn't then go fund investigative journalism. He just took the money.
But by that same logic, couldn't you say that, the horse and buggy industry went out of business because of, there were all these...
But we got something better for it. And I'm saying we got something worse than Craigslist.
When's the last time you looked at a classified ads? It's impossible to find something in the classified ads. I mean, there's no... search, there's no...
I grew up with Craigslist, and so that's all I know. I actually don't know.
I remember having to look for things in classified ads, even little things like, garage sale listings or... Mm-hmm.
Oh, I don't doubt that the benefit to the consumer is there. I just think that in the net, it's a negative to society that money is no longer going to investigative journalism.
I think there's a lot of other reasons, mostly profit motivations, that are the reason we don't have good investigative journalism now. Mm-hmm. It's not because newspapers went out of business. Because there's still, CNN still does investigative journalism, and there's no CNN newspaper.
I don't see too many stories on CNN about, like, we cracked open this...
well, that's because...
this corruption scandal.
The media is shit now, but... speaking of, I'm partially kind of on this because I watched Newsroom last night, which is Aaron Sorkin's new show on HBO, which is kind of about trying to do journalism better, right? Trying to do the news better. But I don't think anyone is, except for newspapers themselves, are hearkening back to the good old days of newspapers.
You're saying that it's been replaced by bloggers and
there is no
Twitter
need for newspapers
and
to exist anymore. Well, news is absolutely needed. Newspapers are not.
I don't know if I necessarily agree that newspapers need to go out of business, because they do serve a purpose, especially for people with restricted or lack of access to technology. But I do think that their prime problem was that they based their entire profitability on one tiny aspect of their business, especially when the internet gained prominence, was definitely under threat. And they should have identified that it was directly under threat and adjusted, and they didn't.
Right, just like the publishing industry and the music industry and all of these things. That's a good argument. I'm not sure where I stand, but I
think the only thing worse than not having any good forward-thinking disruptive ideas of your own is seeing a good forward-thinking disruptive idea and not recognizing it.
Right. Okay, yeah. And we'll leave it on that. That was a good point. All right, and then the next topic is that I wanted to call out... So we were talking last podcast that Ben and I did about the Lean Startup book and the Lean Startup methodology. And I definitely think that there needs to be more scientific thinking in business in general, for sure. Like, there are ways to prove out your ideas without building out the entire system to find out that it fails, right? But I did want to caution, you should read the book, Lean Startup, and learn from it and try to do these things. But there was a company here in New York City that I think did everything right from their perspective and from the Lean Startup perspective, but as far as I know, has lost all their users. And it's because they pivoted too quickly and away from things, and then they abandoned projects too quickly. So they had an app. It was the premier running app on, I think it was called Cardio Trainer. And it was the premier running app on Android, right? And it cost $10, which is kind of expensive for an app,
right?
And so you buy it, or you get the trial version. It's got some limited functionality, but it works. And you're like, oh, that's cool. And I was like, I want to buy this app, get the new functionality.
And this is early on in Android, right? This is like 1.6.
Yeah, they had a version 1.8 or 1.6, their compatibility, and then 2 and so on, to all the way to 2.3. So pretty early on in Android. And I was like, okay, well, I bought it for $10, and the app was working great, and I was like, oh, awesome. But I talked to somebody from this company. This company is now called Noom. And I'll put a link in the show notes because it's spelled funny, too. Like, you pronounce it Noom, but it's got a B in the end.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, well, anyway.
Like Tomb.
Something like that. Yeah, yeah, like Tomb. So it's called Noom. And they were like, you know, I talked to one of the developers, and this is what he said. This was at a Foursquare meetup. And he said, yeah, but we realized that there wasn't enough money in the running tracking business. And so we thought maybe there's more money in the hardware side. And so they created a deal with Polar to create this Bluetooth heart rate monitor that would work with the software, and it would track your heart rate. And so I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. And this thing costs $80, so it's cost way more. I bought it, right? So I bought this thing, and I was like, oh, this will enhance my experience with running and my tracking my metrics and all that stuff. No, it just displays your heart rate. It doesn't actually integrate with the software in any way. It doesn't, like, do the calorie calculation differently from that. And apparently not enough people bought this thing, so they pivoted again. So now I'm $90 into this company.
Right.
Right? They have pivoted to weight loss specifically, like tracking calories and trying to lose weight and have these services and things. And in the meantime, this initial running application, every time they release it, it breaks something else fundamental. The Polar heart rate thing doesn't sync properly, right? Like, you can't get it to work half the time, and it doesn't.
But these things don't work. The lean startup ethos, right? Which is kind
right.
Of
is
move
to
fast,
them they
break things.
Yeah. Move Facebook. Fast, break things. Right. And I think from their perspective, they're like, we're pivoting to profitability, more and more profitability. Like, these things aren't working.
Right. It just sucks. Had some marginal success at the beginning, enough to have some users paying $10 for their app. And if you leave those people behind, they'll be pissed.
Yeah, and they are. If you look at the support forums and stuff for this thing, people are pissed.
So it seems like it's a counterintuitive idea that's actually, and I'm just going from what little I know of it, but if you're constantly making pivoting changes after, you know, like A/B or variant testing, really what you're doing is you're categorizing your early adopters, right?
Right.
And then when you pivot, you're really screwing your early
right.
adopters.
Right. So I think the cautionary tale, you're absolutely right. What I think the cautionary tale here is that they pivoted to completely new markets, as opposed to just pivoting to a better version of their
course correction over, let's go the opposite direction.
It was like another company. Every time they pivoted, it was a completely new company with a new business model and a new way. And that's, I think, too much of a pivot. I don't think that was correct. Now, I'm not
a lot
sure.
of companies pivot, and they're just really just changing their end goal. They don't actually, jump from one type of product to another.
Yeah.
But,
and I mean, in certain cases, that might be what a company needs to do. Like, if their original idea really just has no feet under it. But, the cycle that normal product adoption happens. You get your early adopters, then you get the slightly technical people, then you get everybody else.
Crossing the chasm.
Yeah, you're missing out on a lot of potential data there by jumping too soon.
Right, and so that's just the one caution I wanted to say. Like, the lean startup methodology, it seems like it's good, but don't pivot. You can pivot too quickly, and you can pivot.
Well, you can do it wrong, like anything else, I suppose. But
absolutely, your hypothesis.
Lean startup does address a real problem, which is people who have a certain worldview and base an entire app on a potentially a flawed worldview or a flawed, understanding of how, they just think it's going to, they think they have this grand idea that everyone's going to adopt, and maybe it doesn't work. And if it doesn't work, you should be prepared to abandon it. That's the right philosophy, but you can still do it poorly. And I think, my guess is that Noom's, engineering team is probably not
former Google
top tier.
Yeah. The guy I talked to was former Google. Okay. He left Google to join Noom.
That doesn't necessarily mean anything.
That's fair enough. And then the last thing we'd like to talk about, Ben's startup is actually doing well. They've released some new software.
Right, yeah. Citymaps just released Citymaps 2.0, which looks pretty substantially different, especially on the web end. And that was a fun little sprint. And we're
it looks much better. The whole site.
Thanks. It's it's definitely a big improvement. And we now have kind of a more corporate looking splash page. We can choose what, you know, show off all the different cities that we're in.
Mm-hmm.
And and then there's this whole new sidebar that we use to display
the deals are much more discoverable.
We've dedicated a lot more space to seeing like tweets and deals and cool stuff around. You can call it the Discover panel. It keeps getting better.
That's awesome. Is there anything particular in this release that you're proud of?
I'm really proud of how that sidebar works.
The sidebar.
I think that's the most interesting part of the new release, and it really solved a lot of problems we were having in terms of how to display just a load of information in a pretty recognizable form pretty quickly, which has really always been the main challenge at Citymaps. Is we have so much data, mm-hmm. and there's kind of a familiarity to how a map should look, and we're already sort of breaking that familiarity by putting logos and things on there,
right.
And so it's not overwhelming the user with all this colors and sights and sounds and information. It is I think easy to overwhelm when we're when we're kind of doing this groundbreaking stuff, so keeping it familiar and keeping it easy.
Rock on. Yeah, I recommend everybody check that out. If you're on iOS, they've got a new version of the application too, which is much faster. It's a complete rewrite in OpenGL from the bottom up. Yes. So,
and I suppose there's a Droid version in the works.
There is a Droid version in the works. It's going to be a while, though, I think.
Does the website scale to Droid right now?
We have a somewhat responsive website, but it doesn't scale all the way down to a mobile size. Yeah. It'll scale down to like an iPad type of size and maybe a little smaller than that. But that's actually one of my big projects coming up soon.
Cool.
It's going to be an extremely responsive website. Actually, the way the whole sidebar is designed is actually built to eventually accommodate
it's tab
system.
So on the smaller screen you'll get tabs, and on a larger screen you'll have
On the smaller screen you'll have tabs, and you can close the tab to reveal the map and things like that. So that's the eventual goal of that.
So, yeah. Jeremy works for ZocDoc. Anything fun and exciting there?
I do, but actually, I hate to be a downer, but I just recently had my whole meeting where they told us never to talk about ZocDoc.
Oh, sad.
But no, I mean, the company's exploding, as you can hear just on the net. We're expanding in all these cities. We just released a Spanish version of the site.
How many people, ZocDoc?
Oh, I think I'm allowed to say the official number somewhere around 200.
Okay, cool.
But yeah, it's a fantastic company. We've been hiring a lot of really smart people. So I've been going through and doing like training, and I tried teaching an entire room of recent college graduates, and we'll call them the beginning of their career developers, about fun stuff like solid and proper unit testing and TDD style development, refactoring to accommodate.
This is
change.
The first place that you've been where you have test-driven development, right?
Yes. And, well, I mean, officially. And we're honestly getting there more than we're there.
Okay.
It's something that is our end goal. So we're migrating to that slowly. You know, it's an incremental process. You start...
How's that transition been for you?
For me, it's been a lot of knowledge sharing.
Okay.
You know, it's hard to write code that is testable. I mean, it's not an intuitive process. You know,
and the company has to devote a lot of resources toward writing the test
exactly.
as well.
And there's a huge initial
that whole framework. Yeah,
and you know, you first have to get a basis of tests laid down before you can even start major refactorings, or else you're basically flying the trapeze without a safety net.
Gotcha.
We should have a whole show for TDD sometime. I know we've had some people on, is it Reddit, and a few people have upvoted on Trello on the idea of doing a TDD show.
Yeah, and functional programming as well.
And functional programming as well. But yeah, I'm definitely interested to hear some more about how, like, is there more documentation required in a
it takes more time.
Or is there actually less?
So there's been lots of studies on this. Microsoft even did a study, and it turns out that it takes more time to write test-driven development code than it does to just write code, but it is faster to release.
Exactly. And what's more is, have you ever heard of the 60-60 rule?
No.
So if you look at the total cost, the total effort sunk into any software project, the development portion, that's the requirements analysis, specification, coding, and QA portion, is only about 40% of the total effort that's expended on a project. The remainder 60%, or the remaining 60%, I should say, is maintenance. You know, adding new features, bug fixes, QA, integration, further QA.
Right.
So, and then of that 60%, 60% of that, or what would that be, like 0.3-something percent of the total, is enabling new features, you know, added functionality.
Mm-hmm.
So TDD does require more time on the coding and design portion because you have to kind of plan for it.
Plus right.
You have to also plan for the amount of time it's going to take to write the tests. But that cost is far cheaper than the cost you will end up spending on the extension of new features.
Right.
Because, you know, you're lacking that safety net. You're lacking that cushion that helps you adapt to change.
Yeah, I've heard it put this way. In the book Code Complete, they talk about the cost of a bug.
Yes.
And, like, where you find it in the development process. And it's, like, exponentially more costly the closer you are to release or the closer you are to the final product. If you find a bug in that phase of development, it just costs so much more to fix.
Right. It's exponential.
It's exponential, especially if it's a fundamental design mm-hmm. bug.
Right.
Like, that is the most costly at the end. You find out that your whole system can't work because of some flaw in the design.
Right. And a good unit test is kind of is like documenting something with code.
Oh, it absolutely is.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I mean, I just taught a class on this. So, I mean, from my point of view, the three major benefits of just unit testing in general are, number one, it's primarily for developers. So you know that when you change something, you know exactly what was affected by that change. If you've written your test correctly, because all of the dependencies of a particular piece of code that you're changing
mm-hmm.
should have test coverage, or at least the area where those dependencies come into your system. So the instant that you have a non-local effect, a test should fail.
Right.
So that's absolutely critical for any, like, large-scale...
Right, so what we mean by non-local effect, like, you're changing global state.
Yeah.
You're
relying on a database system.
Basically, they're called side effects, or... they're side effects. In functional programming, they're called side effects.
Well, there's side effects, and then there's just strict dependencies. Like, let's say I change the way that my system interacts with a database. Like, I change that layer.
Mm-hmm.
That has a rippling effect outward because many systems are going to have a dependency on that database system. So the changes that I make will directly affect other code.
Right.
So there's that, and that's primarily for the developer's point of view. You know, that's our help. Then you've got... It's almost like an informal form of documentation, because if you've written your test cases correctly, you can see where the edge cases are just from looking at the names of the tests that you've written.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, the third, and in my opinion, actually the most minor benefit is, you know, catching bugs before they get out into that process.
Well, MVC properly implemented is supposed to mitigate a lot of those issues, but you also have to write tests for every layer.
Yeah, MVC helps you write testable code. Like, a big part of test-driven development is just how do you write this code in a way that it's testable. I think the solution is really dependency injection and...
It's SOLID. I mean, the acronym SOLID, single responsibility. You have code that does one thing and only one thing, such that there's only one reason for you to ever have to go and change it. Open-close, which is more of a way of extending code via wrapping it as opposed to going on the internals of it.
Right. So if you want to add a new feature, you don't go in and modify the function. Instead, you write a new function for the new feature.
Either with proxy to it, or wrap
it. It means that your close is open for extension, but closed for modification.
Exactly. And I mean, the other three letters, everybody's welcome to look up. Liskov substitution is primarily inheritance, you know, fragile inheritance chains. Interface-driven development reduces dependencies because it's a level of abstraction. So your dependencies will end at that level of abstraction because the rest of that system on the other side is effectively opaque, right? You don't know the details of that other system. Therefore, it can't you can't be affected by the changes in those details. And then the... Where am I? D. Dependency inversion. You basically ask for anything you need rather than trying to create it yourself. Because the instant you try to create it, you're bound to the details of it.
Yay. Makes sense.
Sorry. My own little personal rant.
No, that's fine. test-driven development is really interesting to me. This, combined with the lean startup stuff that we were talking about earlier, is really interesting to me. It kind of had me have an epiphany about education and scientific thinking in America. I used to think that being competent in science meant that you knew the results of scientific experiments, right? Like you knew that two objects of different sizes fall at the same rate.
Right.
Right. That is the result of an experiment, right? With two bowling balls,
a test.
And so all of my career or all of my scientific career and my scientific training has been about knowing the results of these things, right? Every multiple choice test I've been given from the New York Regents to college level science classes is all about knowing the results of tests. But real science is about testing, right? Never in a science class have I had to come up with a test to test something that I did not know the answer to. And that, I think, is a real problem in our scientific education. I am now, as I'm trying to test my business and test my code better, am realizing that I'm weak in testing, like very weak in testing. And I just wanted to start that conversation about scientific education.
Well, this coming back to the lean startup, this is why the lean startup model is you don't always know what the results will be.
You're not supposed to know at all.
Right. So be prepared to have the results be something you don't like,
right,
or something you didn't plan for. But at the same time, I see why TDD and lean startups don't tend to go together because of what Jeremy said about it being more expensive on the front end, right? It's a bigger lift, and for most small startups, that's enough to kill it.
It's a perceived bigger lift. There's a lot of
lot of companies have to back into TDD later.
Yeah, I think that's what happens. But all of the research papers I've seen on this, and maybe they're biased, and I probably won't be able to find them, so I can't link them in the show notes, have said pretty concretely that test-driven development is faster. Even though it's slower on the code side, it's faster to release, and faster to release a certain level of quality.
That's the key part, the fast release a certain level of quality. It just hacking it is always faster to release something, right?
Right.
Like I could throw together a script right now for
a way to scrape Craigslist for
there you go
data.
You know, right. Some completely new product model, and I could probably throw together a script to do it in a day or two, but it would be utter crap, and it would be completely write only code.
And if I wanted to add features to it later,
it would be a redesign completely.
Exactly.
Yeah, and they actually talk about that in Lean Startup, and they say that you should go ahead and do what you just said. They say that when you're first trying to figure out your business model and figure out where your value is, release code that's buggy.
And you know, I'm not completely opposed to that idea in concept. I'm very much a proponent of, like, proof of concepts. But you have to be prototype.
Yeah.
You have to be willing to throw your prototype away, and that's where most people fail.
Yes, right, because you've sunk so much cost into it. But like in economics, that's a sunk cost. You shouldn't consider it when you're moving forward.
It sounds like TDD makes pivoting easier, too, back to Noom. I mean, who?
Possibly. They needed unit tests. That was the first thing I said to him when I found out that he was from Noom.
Right.
I go, your company needs unit tests.
just to carry on that's a really good point, is that sort of safety net that I was talking about earlier really makes it possible to pivot easily within constraints. Like if you start changing what we were talking about before, if you go in the opposite direction, it's not going to help you much.
Right. And that solid, you know, design that you were talking about would have also made it possible to create an app and then abandon it without breaking it.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. I think that's all I have to talk about today.
Yeah.
We've got a good show. Yeah. Thank you, Jeremy, for coming by.
No problem.
All right. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.